Ever think about like getting paid for work, even when there's no, formal contract? It's a bit of a head scratcher, isn't it?
Definitely can get pretty tricky.
Yeah, today we're diving into a case that'll make you rethink how business relationships and finances can get really messy.
Yeah, this one's a doozy, and it could have some major implications for how we think about contracts, especially in the world of like complex financing.
Exactly. We're talking about Midcoast Aviation v. GECC.
Okay.
A 1992 decision out of the Seventh Circuit applying Illinois law.
Gotcha.
And it's essentially a story about an aircraft refurbishment that went very, very wrong.
Oh, wow.
Is it a recipe for disaster?
Yeah.
So what
Well,
happened?
what makes this case so interesting is the unusual three-way relationship at its heart.
Okay.
So you have GECC, the deep-pocketed financier who actually owns the plane. Then there's AAI, the middleman leasing the plane from GECC and managing the refurbishment project.
Okay.
And finally, we have Midcoast, the company, doing the actual hands-on work to upgrade the plane. Wow. So it's like a chain reaction gone wrong.
It really is. It's like a legal thriller waiting to happen.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right.
So how does this all connect to this quantum Maru thing?
Well, that's exactly where it gets interesting because that's
Tricky.
how they try and get paid.
Okay.
You ever heard of that?
I have. It's Latin for like as much as it deserves, right?
You got it.
Okay, cool.
Essentially, it's a legal safety net that allows someone to get paid for their work even if there's no explicit contract.
So the court steps in to prevent one party from like getting unjustly enriched at the expense of another.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So, how does this all play out in the Midcoast case?
All right, so let's set the stage. Back in 1985, Midcoast started working on the plane based on a contract with AAI, the middleman.
Okay.
But in 1986, they did even more work based on AAI's promises and some assurances from GECC that they would finance the entire project.
Okay.
Then things went sour.
I'm guessing that's when GECC decided to pull the plug.
You got it. GECC refused to pay Midcoast, leaving them high and dry with a partially upgraded plane and a lot of unpaid bills.
Oh, man.
The problem was Midcoast didn't actually have a contract with GECC, the one holding the purse strings.
So what could Midcoast do? They were stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, it was a tough spot.
That's where this idea of quasi-contract comes in, right?
Right.
Could Midcoast actually get paid by GECC even though there was no direct contract?
That's the million-dollar question, and it all hinges on proving those three key elements of a quantum Maru claim under Illinois law.
Okay, what are those elements?
So first they had to show that they actually conferred a benefit. Did Midcoast's work truly improve GECC's plane?
Well, it sounds like they did quite a bit of refurbishment, so that seems like a pretty clear-cut benefit, right? They put
Yeah.
in the work and added value to the plane.
Absolutely. They poured their time, effort, and resources into the project, enhancing the plane's value in the process.
So that one's kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay, so what's the second element?
All right, so then comes the second element, unjust retention. Did GECC essentially keep the updraft plane without paying for those improvements?
Sounds like a pretty open and shut case to me. They got a refurbished plane without handing over a dime.
Yeah, it seems pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah.
GECC was sitting pretty with a spruced up plane, enjoying the fruits of Midcoast's labor without paying for it. But there's a third, trickier element to consider.
Okay.
The violation of equity, was it truly unfair for GECC to walk away without paying, given their role in this whole refurbishment saga?
Now that's where it gets interesting because GECC wasn't just some random bystander,
Oh,
right? They
exactly.
were the ones pulling the strings behind the scenes.
Precisely. And the court recognized that they weren't convinced by GECC's attempts to downplay their role. GECC tried to argue they only received an incidental benefit from the refurbishment.
Oh, come on.
But let's be real, they own the plane. They were the driving force behind the entire
It
project.
sounds like they were trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, a bit.
So, how did the court ultimately rule?
Well, the court saw right through GECC's argument. They pointed out that GECC was more than just a passive observer. They were deeply involved from the outset and had a vested interest in the plane's upgrade. The court ultimately sided with Midcoast, finding that GECC's benefit from the refurbishment was far from incidental.
Okay, I understand that, but I'm curious, did the jury have all the information they needed to make the right call?
That's a great question.
Did they get the full picture?
That's where things get a little messy, and we'll delve into the fascinating controversy surrounding the jury instructions in the next part.
Can't wait. Okay, so let's unpack this whole jury instruction debate.
Yeah.
It sounds like there were some disagreements about whether the jury got all the information they needed to make a fair decision in the Midcoast case.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. The Seventh Circuit's majority opinion said the jury didn't need to be specifically told about the voluntary acceptance element for liability in this case.
Mm-hmm.
They focused more on the overall fairness, taking into account GECC's involvement in actions throughout the project.
But not everyone on the court agreed with that approach.
Right.
Exactly. The dissenting judge raised some serious concerns. They argued that failing to include a specific instruction about the officiousness defense might swayed the jury.
For those of us who aren't legal scholars, break down this officiousness defense. What does it mean in plain English?
Sure. So basically, it boils down to whether Midcoast acted on their own initiative without any reasonable expectation of payment, or if they were led to believe by AAI and GECC that they would be compensated. The dissenting judge felt that this distinction was crucial for the jury to consider.
So there's this tension between simply preventing unjust enrichment, even if the benefiting party was unaware of the situation, and considering the intentions and expectations of all parties involved.
Yeah, it's a nuanced issue that cuts to the heart of unjust enrichment law. The majority's approach, aligning with the restatement of restitution, prioritizes preventing unjust enrichment as the primary goal.
Even if it means holding sophisticated players like GECC accountable, even if they try to use legal technicalities to avoid paying up.
Precisely, and this raises the question, is Midcoast a sign that courts might be more willing to look beyond the strict letter of the law and consider the broader context of fairness, especially when dealing with parties who should have a good grasp of these legal principles?
It seems like a significant shift holding these financial heavyweights accountable, even when they try to shield themselves behind complex arrangements. But there was also some debate about how damages were calculated, right?
Absolutely. And this is where things get really interesting for litigators. Everyone agreed that the jury was given flawed instructions on how to calculate damages. They were told to consider what it cost Midcoast to do the work, which was around $94,000.
But shouldn't the focus have been on the value GECC received, not just what it cost? Midcoast, that seems like a more accurate way to measure unjust enrichment.
You're exactly right. The correct standard should have been to consider the value of the benefit GECC received. And based on a separate appraisal, that value was significantly lower, around $50,000. This discrepancy ultimately led to the case being sent back for a new trial to reassess the damages.
Wow, what a roller coaster. So what are the key takeaways from this case? It sounds like there's some valuable lessons here for lawyers on both sides of the table, whether they're drafting contracts or arguing cases in court.
Absolutely. For transactional lawyers, this case is a wake-up call. Be wary of financing agreements that give lenders too much control over a project. This can blur the lines of responsibility and create situations where third parties like Midcoast might rely on the lender's assurances even without a direct contract.
So it's not just about crafting airtight contracts, but also about understanding the dynamics of these complex relationships and the potential pitfalls for everyone involved.
Precisely. And for litigators, Midcoast serves as a crucial reminder to always consider the officiousness defense in quasi-contract cases. Did the party providing the services act on their own, or were they led to believe they would be compensated?
That's a critical distinction. And what about those damages? Any advice for our litigator friends out there?
Absolutely. Midcoast highlights the importance of gathering solid evidence about both the cost of services and the value of the benefit received. Remember, the goal is to prevent unjust enrichment, not to punish the defendant. So the damages should reflect the actual benefit received, which might be less than the cost incurred by the plaintiff.
That makes sense. It's about finding that sweet spot of fairness and making sure the compensation aligns with the actual benefit received. But the Midcoast case also raises some intriguing questions about the bigger picture, doesn't it? Like, how does this case fit into broader trends in contract law and financial arrangements?
It's an important point. Midcoast seems to signal a potential shift in how courts apply quasi-contract principles to sophisticated financial institutions. It suggests that courts might be becoming more willing to hold these powerful players accountable, even if they try to hide behind complex legal structures.
So are we seeing a move toward a more equitable approach to quasi-contract claims, especially when these intricate financial arrangements are involved?
Yeah.
It's certainly a possibility, and it's a trend worth watching closely, especially with the rise of fintech and all these innovative but often opaque financial products.
That raises a fascinating question, and it's one we'll tackle in our final part. How might this case apply to modern lending situations with the rise of fintech and all these new players in the financial world? So we've been talking about how Midcoast might signal a shift in how courts handle these quasi-contract cases, especially when you've got these big financial players involved. But how does this all play out in the wild west of modern lending, you know, with the rise of fintech and all these new, sometimes confusing financial products?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. And I think Midcoast offers some really valuable insights, even though it's a case from way back in 1992, you know, the core principles at play here are still so relevant today.
Like, wait, give me an example.
Well, think about it this way. Imagine a startup that's using a peer-to-peer lending platform to secure funding for a new project. They rely on the platform's assurances about the terms and conditions of the loan. But somewhere down the line, there's a dispute. Maybe the platform changes the terms without clear notice, or there's confusion about who's responsible for what.
Yeah, I can see where things could get messy fast. You've got all these different parties, complex algorithms and agreements that are often buried in pages of fine print.
Exactly. And in those situations, Midcoast reminds us that courts might be more willing to look beyond the strict letter of the contract and consider the broader context. Was there a true meeting of the minds? Did one party gain an unfair advantage by exploiting a power imbalance or a lack of transparency?
So it's not just about what's written in the contract, but also about the overall fairness of the situation. Especially when you're dealing with these new fast-moving financial technologies where the rules are still being written.
Right, and that's where Midcoast becomes so crucial. It provides a framework for analyzing these complex situations and ensuring that everyone is playing by the rules, even when those rules are still being defined.
Sounds like there are some important lessons here for everyone, from startup founders to investors to the companies developing these new financial products. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to someone navigating this brave new world of lending?
I'd say the key is awareness. Understand the potential implications of quasi-contract law, even when there's no traditional written agreement. Be mindful of the power dynamics in these arrangements and the possibility that someone might be misled or left in a vulnerable position.
So to your homework, don't just assume everything worked out because you clicked I agree on a website. It's about being proactive and protecting your own interests, even in the face of complex technology.
Absolutely. And for those of us on the litigation side, Midcoast serves as a powerful reminder to consider the full spectrum of legal arguments when representing clients who might have been wronged in these types of transactions.
Don't be afraid to think outside the box and push the boundaries of legal interpretation, especially as the financial landscape continues to evolve at such a rapid pace.
Exactly. Because at the end of the day, justice isn't just about following the letter of the law. It's about ensuring fairness and preventing one party from unjustly benefiting at the expense of another. And sometimes that means looking beyond the surface, understanding the nuances of these intricate financial transactions, and applying the principles of equity to ensure everyone gets what they deserve.
Well, that's our deep dive into Midcoast Aviation v. GECC. A fascinating case that shows us how the law is grappling with the complexities of modern finance.
It's a good reminder that even in the fast-paced world of fintech and ever-evolving financial products, the fundamental principles of fairness and justice still apply.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep into the fascinating world of law and its impact on our lives.